Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
I've been trying to write a promo for our podcast, Part-Time Genius, but even though we've done over 250 episodes, we don't really talk about murders or cults.
I mean, we did just cover the Illuminati of cheese, so I feel like that makes us pretty edgy. We also solve mysteries like how Chinese is your Chinese food and how do dollar stores make money? And then, of course, can you game a dog show?
So what you're saying is everyone should be listening.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was wooden.
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. My name is Rob Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick, and today we're doing Mad Love.
That's right. This is a film that I've been excited to do on Weird House Cinema, even before we really formalized what this would be. Now, before we get into the movie, you might be asking, well, what do this be? What is Weird House Cinema? You may think of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, and of course you think of a science and culture show. Well, Stuff to Blow Your Mind remains a science and culture podcast on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Friday night is our time to focus on weird films. We may also discuss science and culture on this show, but we put the weird horse ahead of the cart on these days. Think of this show as the haunted hands of a movie podcast grafted onto the body of a science podcast.
I like it. So this is a movie that's come up on Stuff to Blow Your Mind proper before. I think maybe, did it come up in talking about, cutting off parts of the body and retaining memories? I think it's come up a few times because I had never seen the movie before, but I had seen the trailer for Mad Love. And the trailer is just wonderful because it begins with Peter Lorre sitting on a couch next to a dog that's bigger than he is and getting a phone call from a beautiful actress who wants to tell him how great he is in the movie that they starred in together.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those wonderfully weird trailers that's just so different from anything you see today, because it begins with this supposedly real life conversation where she's like, "Oh, Peter Lorre, I loved you in M. Tell me about this new film you have coming up." And then you go to a more proper trailer.
That's right. And for such a mundane beginning of a trailer, this is a fabulously strange movie, especially for what year? Did it come out in 1934? Is that right?
35, I believe.
Okay. 34, 35. Yeah, I think you're right. 35. And wow, what a strange film. It's got one of the strangest things I think we should just sell right up front is there is a costume that Peter Lorre puts on in the later half of the movie that, like, is just hard to believe it comes from the era that it does. It seems very cybernetic.
Yeah, it is frightening to behold. But yeah, outside of that, there are just a number of crazy, weird elements in this film, and it has at least two eccentric performances. The first and foremost, that of Peter Lorre, which we'll get into in a minute. But You know what? I'll go ahead and do the elevator pitch for this movie. So, you know, generally what we're talking about here before we get into discussing the players. A gifted but deranged surgeon named Dr. Gogol becomes obsessed with horror actress Yvonne Orlok. And when Yvonne's husband, the famous pianist Stephen Orlok, suffers a brutal accident, Gogol transplants the hands of an executed killer onto Orlok. And from here, everything just spirals into this this kind of weird tale of psychological manipulation and delusion.
Let's hear just a snip of that trailer.
I, a poor peasant, have conquered science. Why can't I conquer love? He shall be shut up when it's I who am mad. But nobody knows that. Yes, each man kills the thing he loves.
So one of the things that maybe we should start with is the title of this movie, because it doesn't really communicate what this film is really all about, which is like severed hands and crazy psychological manipulation.
Yeah, Mad Love is, I think, kind of an imperfect title. I far prefer the alternative title. It sometimes it plays under, and that is The Hands of Orlok. Though that one also feels somewhat, I don't know, insignificant, given the focus of the film is not on Orlok as much as it is on Dr. Gogol, Peter Lorre's character. I also think, for modern viewers, there's also this. We also have to take into mind that you have this 1995 film that's also called Mad Love that many of us might have remembered. If you didn't see it, then maybe you just saw the trailers, and it starred Chris O'Donnell and Drew Barrymore, and none of the plot elements we're discussing here. It's a completely unrelated film. I'm sure it's quite nice. It was directed by Antonia Bird, who of course directed Ravenous in 1999 and Priest in 1994. One. But yeah, nothing to do with Peter Lorre and The Hands of Orlok or anything.
I believe it was based on a short story called The Hands of Orlok, right? Like Les Mains d'Orlok?
Yeah. This was by French fantasy and horror writer Maurice Renard, who lived 1875 through 1939. And I wasn't really familiar with the works of Renard, but he wrote multiple tales of mad scientists, alien beings, futuristic technology. And this is just one of four screen adaptations of The Hands of Orlok. And it wasn't the first. The first was a 1924 silent Austrian film starring Conrad Veidt, who many of you may know from The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or The Man Who Laughs, which even if you haven't seen it, you may have seen a still from it because it's often discussed as being an inspiration for the Joker in the Batman franchise.
Yeah, a really otherworldly, disturbing face. In Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, does he play Cesar, the somnambulist?
I believe so. I have a hard time remembering the characters in Caligari as much as just the breathtaking visuals. That's mm-hmm. Certainly when it comes to silent films worth watching today, that's one of the good ones. Anyway, Conrad played Orlok in that, but there was no Gogol. Instead, there was a less essential character, a surgeon named Dr. Sarah. So it seems that by the time they end up making Mad Love, like they've adapted it enough, they've made more of a character out of the surgeon. The surgeon has become the center of the piece as opposed to just this contemplation of futuristic hand transplantation and how that affects our idea of body and personality integrity. Now, there were a couple of other adaptations of The Hands of Orlok. One was a 1960 French-British adaptation that actually had Christopher Lee in it playing Nero the Magician, which I think was just enough. I don't know why you would mess around with the plot that much, but there you go. And then in 1962, there was an American adaptation titled Hands of a Stranger. It starred nobody in particular. I think the main noteworthy thing about it is that director Newt Arnold also directed Bloodsport and was assistant director on a lot of major films such as Blade Runner and The Godfather Part 2.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. But the basic plot element here of of what you could think of as transplant panic, and the idea of a transplanted limb altering an individual's personality. You see that showing up in a great many films and TV episodes. Just to name a few, there was The Hand of Fear, an episode of the Tom Baker era Doctor Who series. There's 1991's Body Parts, starring Jeff Fahey.
Jeff Fahey?
Yeah. Yeah,
Lawnmower Man?
Yeah. Lindsay Duncan and Brad Dourif. And then you'll find various horror anthology episodes, I think, that they either have this particular plot of, I have the hands of a killer or the hands of a stranger on my body, mm-hmm. as well as a related but different form of dismemberment panic films about disembodied crawling hands. I'd love to come back to crawling hand films in the future.
Oh, maybe a future October episode.
Yeah.
Now, this reminds me of something we talked about not too long ago on Stuff to Blow Your Mind when we did the episode I Want a New Blood that was all about blood transfusions and how there were experiments in the 17th century, as far back as the 17th century in France, to transfuse the blood of animals into humans for various reasons, some of which were not necessarily all that grounded in good science. But, for example, you might perform a phlebotomy because of the Galenic humoral theory of the day. You'd bleed a patient to reduce a fever or to reduce mania or something. And then there were some surgeons at the time who said, you know what we should do is take out the bad blood and then replace it with the blood of an animal that has the sort of personality characteristics that we want to put into the person. So if somebody is overly excited, they're suffering from a mania, you would put lamb's blood into their body because the gentleness and coolness of the lamb would come through in the blood. And this also, but this was also countered by people who opposed blood transfusions on the idea that you could create some kind of hybrid creature that, like, negative qualities of the original animal would come through in the new person and they wouldn't really be fully human anymore. So there's long been this idea that transfusing blood from one creature to another or transplanting a body part from one creature to another or one person to another brings with it some kind of personality characteristic.
Yeah, yeah. This concern over the integrity of the body, when we get into the transplantation of tissues and fluids and organs and limbs. And I think one, of course, thing to note is that while a lot of the concerns over over blood have sort of passed away with the widespread use of blood transfusions, you know, you will find some religious objections to blood transfusions here and there. But for the most part, it has become a part of our everyday life, you know? Like, you, even if you're not giving blood every day, you may hear about blood drives, etc. It's just part of the medical reality of the modern world. Hand transplants, as we'll discuss a little later, are far rarer. They are a far more complicated procedure and one that is not every day, and also one that is, you know, it seems like our ability to pull it off is still evolving. So you definitely see that same kind of energy in these transplantation panic films and other bits of fiction that sort of deal with this idea. What if the hands of another became my hands? Would they really be my hands? And that, of course, is one of the key things going on in this film.
I like the idea, though, of these science fiction films that take a very scientifically, or at least ostensibly scientifically grounded premise. This is about medical science performing experiments at the edge of what was known to medicine at the day. Mm-hmm. But it still basically believes in magic. This movie still basically believes that, like, hands contain some magical essence of the brain of the person they came from. And it seems to me, modern science fiction doesn't usually operate on quite that level of belief in the supernatural.
Yeah, there's certainly a dash of the supernatural in this one. There is a lot of science fiction. You know, it is essentially, like, science fiction is always about our hopes and our anxieties concerning where technology is taking us. And, you know, at the time, it was looking towards a future in which we would be able to carry out hand transplants or certainly double hand transplants. We eventually got to that point. But at the time, it was just it was pure speculation. It was just we may get to this point, and then when we get there, what will it mean? What if it goes wrong? And then the way it goes wrong is goes a bit more in the speculative and magical direction by going beyond like what if it doesn't work, but also getting into that area of what if it isn't me anymore.
Now, if you have seen any image from this film, and I think there's a decent chance you have, it is probably the image of Peter Lorre in his Rollo costume. And we'll explain how that fits into the plot a little bit more in more detail later. But in this costume, it's Peter Lorre wearing this bizarre metal and leather neck brace that goes over his shoulders and goes up to his chin and is laced up with like a shoe. And then with metal hands and dark sunglasses or almost kind of welding goggles and a big black hat.
Yes, it is a really nightmarish image to behold. I feel like it was definitely an influence on the Gestapo agent Tot in Raiders of the Lost Ark, played by Ron Lacey. And Ron Lacey gives a very Lorre-esque performance in that, especially when you take into account the coat and the hat as well. And also early character concepts for that character in Raiders apparently gave him a cybernetic metal arm. I feel like there's some strong comparisons to be made there, and I think I have read that that Spielberg went with Lacey because he reminded him of Peter Lorre.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, this is getting us into the people who were involved in this movie, so maybe we should start with looking at the director, Carl Freund, who was a cinematographer before he was a director proper, and I recognized this name immediately when it came up in the opening credits, and I realized where I recognized it from was from the movies of Fritz Lang.
That's right. He was cinematographer on Metropolis. As well as the 1931 Dracula film.
Oh, yeah.
Was another film that he was cinematographer on. He was a cinematographer on, I think, 163 films, according to IMDb, and was active through the 1960s.
He worked on some other Universal horror films, I think, didn't he? Was he involved with The Mummy?
Yeah, he directed 1932's The Mummy, starring Boris Karloff as Imhotep.
Oh, okay.
But the main attraction here, really, the centerpiece is Peter Lorre as Dr. Gogol. Lorre is the ultimate highlight in this film, as the picture, I think, gives him a chance to shine just in multiple ways. Because as Gogol, it's interesting. He's sometimes quite dapper and sly, walking around, smoking, gazing kind of slyly at everything around him. Other times, he's this tragic, earnest, even manic character. And then there's this scene, which again, we'll get into more of the details on in a bit, where he takes on the guise of this reassembled Rollo character, and he gives a really otherworldly performance in this kind of science fiction within a science fiction. And then ultimately the whole plot just crescendos into madness, and he plays an increasingly mad character. So Lorre, I feel like, really gets to just trot out all the tools in this particular movie.
I think that when Mad Love was first released, it was mostly or at least partially critically panned. I think people looked at it okay, this is childish trash. But even in those reviews, there was a lot of praise for Lorre because Peter Lorre is obviously, one of the great actors, one of the great film actors of all time.
Yeah, he was a Hungarian-American actor of Jewish descent. Made a whole career basically out of playing weird characters, just weirdos. He had kind of a weird asymmetrical look, and he had this wonderful accent and this kind of raspy voice. The voice, I don't even have to do an impression because you're hearing it now. You may already be speaking it out loud just to hear yourself use it. I mean, it's a universally known voice. He was a legend of cinema. Now, this was his first American film on the heels of 1931's much acclaimed M by Fritz Lang. And then he played an accused child murderer. And he would go on to have memorable roles in The Maltese Falcon in 41, of course, Casablanca in 42, along with just a long list of great, memorable, and occasionally forgettable or embarrassing films. But he worked with such directors as John Huston, Alfred Hitchcock, Frank Capra. He pretty much did it all.
I mean, Lorre
I think, is a great early example of someone who would be well known in their own right as a powerhouse film star without being a dashing lead, without being like, you know, an attractive actor or actress who would play the lead role in films to be the hero. Laurie was often a villain or a strange character actor. And I don't know how common it was at the time for actors like that to be a household name that was, you know, known and revered.
Yeah, like you see footage of him, such as in that trailer, you know, like how many weird actors and character actors today can you even imagine such a setup, you know, where you're coming at everyone first with the celebrity and the natural charisma of the actor, and then you hit the trailer. And I think it speaks to, you know, one of the things about him is like he was charismatic. He was, you know, kind of dashing in his own slightly anti-Hollywood way. And like I say, he also just became cemented in popular culture. I was looking around for books about him, and I ran across The Animated Peter Lorre by Matthew Hahn. This is a book that points out apparently 700 instances of animated cartoons using Lorre's face or voice or both. So this is everything from old-timey cartoons where it's like, oh, suddenly a bunch of dead celebrities have shown up, and here's one of them. It's Peter Lorre. To just characters like on Scooby-Doo or whatever that may not be Peter Lorre, but have his voice and or his appearance. And you see that still today. Like the Peter Lorre impersonation is kind of like a standard impersonation one might turn to. You see it, for instance, in the Star Wars Clone Wars animated series. There's a character that shows up, a bounty hunter named Cad Bane, and it has kind of like a mechanically augmented voice, but the root of it is a Peter Lorre impersonation, and you can pinpoint it.
Oh, that's interesting. I like how that connects Star Wars to the classic old serials.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, like, this is a guy that people like Spielberg and Lucas, you know, they grew up watching these films. Like, he was one of the maybe not the top tier deities, but one of the supporting deities in the pantheon of film.
Now, there's another actor in the movie who I think is maybe weirder than people realized when they cast him. I don't know. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to be the hero of the film, but this is Colin Clive playing Stephen Orlak, who appeared in the Frankenstein movies. He was Dr. Frankenstein in James Whale's Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, and he has such a rat-like nervous energy in this film. It's similar, actually, to what you see in the Frankenstein movies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in both films, he plays an accomplished and seemingly confident man who is then riddled by madness and trauma. You know, has gone through a traumatic experience and is continually haunted by what has occurred. And yeah, he seems to just. And I have to admit, I've only seen Colin Clive in this movie, Mad Love, and the two Frankenstein films of note. But in all three of those, like, he just has this wonderful raw energy to him, and there is this sense of like tragedy too. I don't know how much of the tragedy is just knowing that, for instance, he would die in 1937, just 2 years later, at the age of 37, and that he had a number of demons in his life. I believe he suffered from alcoholism, but you know, whatever traumas he had in his life, you know, he seems able to have translated that into these performances. And so, yeah, he's perfect for this role as this, you know, handsome and accomplished individual who is then put through this traumatic situation and then pushed towards delusion by the villainous Dr. Gogol.
He has this energy as if he's undergoing fission. You think yes. that you're going to walk into a room and catch him just chewing on a corner of the wall.
Yeah.
Now, there's another major actress in this film, Frances Drake, who plays Stephen Orlak's wife, Yvonne Orlak, the heroine of the film, who plays an actress within the movie. But one thing before we get into details about Frances Drake that I thought was interesting is I read that originally this role of Yvonne Orlak was cast with another actress, an actress named Virginia Bruce. And just clicking around on the internet, I discovered that Virginia Bruce played Jane Eyre in a 1934 American adaptation of the Bronte novel. And in this movie, Colin Clive, the guy with the fission rat nervous energy, plays Mr. Rochester. I don't know. I would have to see that to believe it, because Mr. Rochester is supposed to be this, you know, dark, smooth, Byronic hunk, but Colin Clive's teeth are almost audibly rattling when you watch him. It's hard to imagine him really fitting with that role.
I'm going to have to watch that or watch some clips from it just to see, you know, what kind of energy he has in that. Because again, I've only seen this level of energy out of Colin Clive. Now, Francis Drake is quite good in this. It's easy to lose sight of her because she is kind of sandwiched between these very manic performances. But she was a star of the day. She was only active from 1933 to 1942. But she lived a long life, lived to see the 21st century. What happened is she married into the English aristocracy, and her first husband, Lieutenant Cecil John Arthur Howard, urged her to leave show business, so she did. But she's really good in this. I mean, it's one of these roles that you encounter for women in films, of particularly of this era, where you feel like it's definitely suffering from the limitations of female roles at the time. You know, like, you know, she's going to faint when the villain comes at her. You know, she's going to be saved by the male hero of the piece, that sort of thing. But that being said, she's really good in it. You know, she's able to. I mean, it's kind of interesting. She doesn't come off as a scream queen. I'm not sure if that was truly a thing yet, but that at the same time, she kind of plays a scream queen. Yes. I mean, her character is a scream queen in the context of the film.
Yeah, her character, Yvonne Orlock, is playing a scream queen of the Grand Guignol Theater in Paris. It's not mm-hmm. named as the Grand Guignol Theater, but the Grand Guignol historically is this tradition of extremely gory, morbid stage productions that would be done in Paris. And in this movie, it's called the Théâtre des Horreurs, or I don't have French pronunciation. Sorry. The Theater of Horrors. And it's got all mm-hmm. these creeps sitting in the audience every night, just watching her get tortured on the rack. Yep. and doing a marvelous job screaming. And so she clearly has her fans. I think she's sort of supposed to be the Linnea Quigley of her day.
Yeah. And of course, those creepy fans include one super creepy fan, Dr. Gogol. So he is kind of like the ultimate creepy fan in this. A very successful creepy fan, but a creepy fan nonetheless.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that Frances Drake got out of acting because she married a successful husband who did not want her to further pursue her career, because that is the role she plays in this movie. Yvonne Orlock mm-hmm. is retiring from acting at the Theater of Horrors because she's marrying a successful husband and they're moving to England.
Yeah, that is interesting. I having not read The Hands of Orlock or seen the previous adaptation, I don't know if that was part of the original or like a lot of things in Mad Love, if it's been embellished and added upon. Now, believe it or not, there is another screen legend in this film, and that is Key Luke. You might know him best as the man who sells Gizmo to that kid in 1984's Gremlins.
Well, I think he sells him to the kid's dad, right? The kid's...
That's true. The dad gets Gizmo as a gift to give the kid. Or does he actually sell him, or does he kind of... the dad steal him, like, after he won't sell him? I forget how that goes down exactly.
I don't recall exactly. I mean, Key Luke is the proprietor of the Shop of Accursed Items.
Mm-hmm.
And he's good in this film, though it's a small role. He plays Dr. Gogol's... colleague, basically. He's the other surgeon that works at Dr. Gogol's clinic.
Yeah. What I like about his role in Mad Love is that he's simply playing another doctor, Dr. Wong, in a straightforward part, which, I mean, it's kind of complicated to think about, because on one hand, you had a lot of stereotypical Asian characters in films at the time. And in many cases, those characters were played by non-Asian actors. Mm-hmm. Laurie himself would go on to play a stereotypical Asian character, Mr. Moto, in several pictures. And this was just sadly the practice in Hollywood at the time. You see, you would see, and even the decades to follow, you'd see actors like Boris Karloff, Christopher Lee, Rex Harrison, Katharine Hepburn, Mickey Rooney, Alex Guinness, just to name a few names, you know? And so it feels perversely progressive to have Luke in this role playing just a surgeon. Yet at the same time, I read that Luke himself pointed out that he was often cast in, quote, good Boy Scout roles like doctors and lawyers, which in this also entails racial stereotyping, you know. So we have to keep both extremes in mind when looking at films like this, as well as with films today. Now, that being said, Key Luke, though, interesting character, very long career in Hollywood. I believe he started out in the advertising realm of Hollywood, like promotional posters and all, and just became a staple of Hollywood.
Oh, that's interesting. I never heard that.
Yeah.
Guess what, Bango?
What's that, Will?
So iHeart is giving us a whole minute to promote our podcast, Part-Time Genius.
I know. That's why I spent my whole week composing a haiku for the occasion. It's about my emotional journey in podcasting over the last 7 years, and it's called Earthquake House.
Mango, I'm going to cut you off right there. Why don't we just tell people about our show instead?
Yeah, that's a better idea. So every week on Part-Time Genius, we feed our curiosity by answering the world's most important questions. Things like, when did America start dialing 911? Is William Shatner's best acting work in Esperanto? Also, what happened to Esperanto?
Plus, we cover questions like how Chinese is your Chinese food? How do dollar stores stay in business? And of course, is there an Illuminati of cheese?
There absolutely is, and we are risking our lives by talking about it. But if you love mind-blowing facts, incredible history, and really bad jokes, make your brains happy and tune in to Part-Time Genius.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Sue. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar on the business. I understand now. He's a wise man, marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh?
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations solutions that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, well, I guess maybe we should talk through the plot in a little bit more detail. Now, we've already discussed the basic setup that Yvonne Orlak, played by Frances Drake, is this grand guignol scream queen, that she goes on stage at the Theater of Horrors every night in Paris. They grotesquely torture her for whatever play they're putting on. It looks like the play they're putting on is about a count or some, you know, wicked aristocrat who finds out that his wife is two-timing him and then puts her on the rack. And so they put her on this big wheel and start stretching her arms, and she screams, and then it shows these people in the audience where there, it looks like there are a lot of couples in the audience and the women are like not happy to be there, and the men are like, oh wow, this is great. But she seems to enjoy her job acting in this theater, and she talks about her husband Stephen Orlak. I think it's communicated that they are recently married. Stephen Orlak, again, is played by Colin Clive, and he is a genius pianist. So like when she's preparing to go out on stage in her dressing room, she's listening to a performance that he's doing live on the radio. And I think we're supposed to understand that they're very happily married. They adore one another. And the film opens on the night of Yvonne's final performance at the Theater of Horrors before she's going to move off to England with Stephen. But as you mentioned, Yvonne has a creepy secret admirer among the audience. Dr. Gogol, it is said, is there every single night in his theater box. He's basically keeping the theater running, constantly buying this expensive box seat to watch her from.
Because Dr. Gogol, I'm not sure if we firmly established this, but he is a superstar surgeon of the day. Like he is a wealthy super talented surgeon who is clearly, I don't know if he's really performed anything, miracle level yet at this point, in the timeline, but like he's out there saving lives. Like there's a scene where he has saved a child's life through his brilliant surgical intervention.
Yes, it's communicated that he has a very powerful mind and very gifted hands, coming back to a theme throughout the movie. And so he saves children's lives. They talk about how he saves soldiers who have been injured in the war. They don't talk about what war. This is 1930s in Paris, so I guess that would refer to World War I. I'm not sure. But then Dr. Gogol finds out that this is Yvonne's last night, and he does not like this. He's horrified, in fact, because he is obsessed with her. He's there every night to see her. Like she says, I'm leaving. And then he's like, oh, what theater are you going to? And she's like, well, actually, I'm just moving to England. And he doesn't like this at all. He's distraught. But fortunately for Dr. Gogol, the theater happens to be removing a wax figure of Yvonne. They have it like standing out in the lobby. And it looks so much like her that it is in fact played by her. It's just Frances Drake standing there, not moving. But they're taking the wax figure out of the theater so it can be melted down for scrap wax. And then Gogol intercepts this delivery, buys the wax figure of her, and he has it delivered to his apartment. The whole time he's monologuing about the myth of Pygmalion and Galatea.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great scene because the guy clearly thinks it's creepy, and Gogol just, offers him enough money to buy it. It's kind of like a pre eBay, creepy eBay transaction,
Yes. Yes. Very. But I don't quite understand how it's supposed to be like the myth of Pygmalion or of Galatea, because he doesn't make the wax sculpture. He just buys it, but he keeps dreaming that it's going to come to life and love him.
Yeah. Yeah, ranting about the Galatea. I love it. And I love that it's just Frances Drake playing the wax duplicate, and without any, I don't think they did anything to her. They just have her stand there in costume, which is nice because it plays in with what is to come later in the plot.
Yeah. So next thing is we meet the pianist, Stephen Orlak, on a train. And there's a scene that comes here that I love so much. The sausage slash dog scene is just amazing. So Orlak is riding in a train car. Across from him, there's a passenger who's just eating a giant sausage. I'm pretty sure it's a sausage. I don't know what else it could be. It's not a baguette because it shows him holding a baguette next to it. So I think it's just a huge sausage the size of a baguette.
And I don't remember this part of the movie as much. Does the guy with the baguette have like a snappy American accent?
No. He's supposed to be French, I believe.
Okay. All right. So the snappy American characters are yet to come. Okay.
They're yet to come. Yes. The guy eating the huge sausage, I think, is French. And next to him on the bench in the train car is a picnic basket. And then suddenly a little puppy pops up out of the picnic basket, pops up its head. And the man explains to Colin Clive, he's like, well, it costs 20 francs extra if you want to bring a dog on the train. So I'm sneaking the dog on in my picnic basket and don't let the guards find out. And then Colin Clive wonderfully says, if my silence is worth 20 francs, buy it. I'm hungry. So the guy cuts off a piece of his monster sausage and gives it to Orlak. And then Orlak immediately gives the sausage to the basket dog. And then the sausage man after that abandons all pretense of utensil use. He like puts down his knife and he just gnaws it. He just sticks the thing in his mouth and bites it like an apple.
Yeah, I never sausage a scene. it's one of several humorous scenes in this film that at once feel completely out of place, but also, you know, I wouldn't want this film without them. Like they're interesting. They're funny. I don't know if they're funny in the way they would have been received at the time, but there's something kind of slapsticky and amusing about them.
I think it's supposed to be funny. Any case, whatever it was supposed to be, Sausage Man is my hero. I want action figures of Sausage Man. I want our fans to make us Sausage Man t-shirts.
It would have been a totally different film, by the way, had Sausage Man's hands end up transplanted onto Stephen Orlok.
Oh my God, yes. Like, I can't play the piano anymore. I can only grab huge sausages. But anyway, that preludes the next thing we have to talk about, which is that a prisoner is brought on board the train, and it is explained that this is Rollo the Knife Thrower, who is skilled at throwing knives. I guess that's a skill. Mm-hmm. I'd never thought about that much before. But what do they say he did? I think it's that he murdered his own father by throwing a knife at him.
Yep, which will become important later on. He's a convicted murderer, and he's on the way to the guillotine.
His mannerisms are very soft and friendly and American. They specify he is American. He's not French. He just happens to be in France going to the guillotine. And he comes off almost kind of like Buddy Hackett.
Yes. He reminds me a lot of, and I'm sorry, I forget the actor's name, but the actor who plays Babyface Nelson in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? You know, that kind of old-timey, he comes off as a charismatic, likable character, not a knife-wielding murderer. And on one hand, I found myself thinking, well, what if they had actually made Rollo terrifying here? Would that have been more beneficial later on? But maybe I'm not sure it would, because I don't know, the impersonation of a animated Rollo that comes later is very much a Gogol creation. So I don't know. I guess ultimately I'm okay with this particular character being a little hammy and a little likable despite being a murderer.
Well, I think it kind of works because Gogol, if I recall correctly, has never meets Rollo while he's alive.
Right.
He only gets access to his dead body once it's guillotined.
Yeah.
But we should say before Rollo gets guillotined through happenstance, orchestrated by Sausage Man, by the way, because Sausage Man wants Rollo's autograph. He apparently collects the autographs of famous people, including father murderers. He goes next to the other train car using Stephen Orlak's pin to try to get an autograph. Orlak has to go get his pin, and so by these means, he meets Rollo.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Rollo gets off the train to get executed. Laurie goes to the guillotining because apparently he always does. But after Rollo gets off the train tragically derails, and Stephen survives the crash, but his hands are mangled and destroyed.
Mm.
And of course, he's a pianist by trade, so he needs his hands to play. And Yvonne wants to, so she's talking to the surgeon in the hospital after the accident, saying, "Can't you save his hands?" And the surgeon's like, "I'm sorry, ma'am, we'll have to amputate." So Yvonne is desperate, and she realizes, "Oh, I've got this creepy admirer, Dr. Gogol, and he's the world's greatest surgeon. I can take Steven to him." And so that's what she does. She has Steven taken in an ambulance to Dr. Gogol's clinic and says, "You've got to save his hands. He needs them to play." But unfortunately, Dr. Gogol discovers it is impossible to salvage his hands as they are. But Gogol, in his desire to please Yvonne, manages to transplant Rollo the knife thrower's hands onto Steven's wrists.
Yes, he decides to essentially try the impossible. There's that great scene where he's in there with Dr. Wong Laurie's character proclaims impossible. Napoleon said that word is not French.
Yes, that part's great. Yeah. So it seems for a while like all is well, you know. Yeah. Steven discovers that his hands work and everything's good until Steven starts to figure out that he can't play the piano anymore. You hear there are these scenes of him sort of banging on the keys with nothing like the deafness that he's used to. And he can't play the piano, but he can do things he couldn't do before, such as accurately throw knives and pins so that they stick into doors and walls.
Yes.
How does he discover this? I think he just gets angry. So yeah. This is part of the personality bleed over too, because there's the idea that his hands have the skills of Rollo with throwing a knife, but they also have Rollo's murderous inclinations that he's suddenly violent when he wasn't before. Now, this leads to all kinds of problems because he can't play piano. Suddenly, they're in want of money, and Steven and Yvonne's position just sorts to fall apart. And Yvonne goes to Gogol for help. Gogol, of course, demands her love, and she won't give it to him. And then in a fit of rage, Gogol decides that he needs to drive Steven mad.
Yes.
So his plan is that he's going to commit murders and then assume the identity of Rollo the knife thrower, who Steven knows was executed, and try to convince Steven that Steven himself did the murders that Gogol actually did by telling him the truth that he has Rollo's hands on his wrists, and using as proof the fact that he, Gogol, pretending to be Rollo, is now still alive because Gogol transplanted his dead head onto another person's body. And this is when Gogol, as Rollo, dons that amazing outfit with the neck brace and the leather and the steel hands.
Yeah, and it is a really haunting scene. It is if you don't have the, I don't know, the courage or the time to watch the full movie. I think there's a clip of this, an official clip of just this scene online, and yeah, it's wonderful. So there's the costume level of it, which we've described already, but also Gogol as Rollo is speaking in this faint whisper, this raspy whisper, you know, the voice of one whose head has been refused with his body, and he feels at once like this strange, perverse miracle of modern surgery, but also he's like a ghost. He's like a wraith brought back to warn Orlok of what is to come.
I am a little confused about Gogol's plan, or the logic of it. So I think what he thinks is that if he can falsely convince Steven that he did murders, this will cause Steven to continue to actually do murders.
Right, or get caught by the police, either by turning himself in or just by doing more murders.
Yeah.
Either way, it's a win for Gogol, because then he can swoop in and, you know, he and Yvonne will be married and live happily ever after.
Yeah, he sort of neglects to consider the fact that Yvonne doesn't want to marry him. Gogol is not thinking clearly at this point.
Right. He doesn't have a good head for romance.
No.
You know, he asks that question at one point. He says, "I, a poor peasant, have conquered science. Why can't I conquer love?" And I mean, clearly he has a great head for science, but not for love. He doesn't really understand how love works. And, you know, he can certainly use his technical skills and his brilliant mind to put the hands of a dead man onto the hands of a survivor. But in terms of transplanting Yvonne into his life, that is beyond his ability. But he still has this wonderfully, perhaps overly complex plan to pull it off. It may sound a bit overly complex here, but I don't know. I feel like within the context of this plot, in the context of this movie, it works. You just kind of have to roll with it, but it works.
Yeah, it just sort of skips lightly over the top of the water and then moves on.
Yeah.
So, of course, Stephen is implicated in these murders that Gogol did, or at least one murder. I think maybe it's just one, actually. And so he's arrested by the police, and Yvonne goes to Gogol's apartment to confront him. But then while she's there, she discovers his evil plan.
That's right, because he's coming back in the Rolo costume, cackling to himself about basically reveals his entire plot, and then taking the costume off. And what does she do to hide?
Oh, wait, no, before we get there, I've got to say about when he's explaining the plot, he's not even doing the Bond villain explaining it to Bond. He's doing the Bond villain explaining his whole scheme to no one. He's just explaining it to the ceiling.
Well, there's a parrot there, right? Isn't there a bird?
Oh, maybe it is the parrot.
There is a bird, yeah.
Okay, I take it back. Maybe he's explaining to the bird. But yes, so he's coming home. He's coming into his study. She's there because she had come to confront him. And then she discovers... She has to hide, and in this suspenseful final scene, she has to pretend to be the wax sculpture of herself, which is a fantastic set piece.
And it's really well shot, too. There's this wonderful sort of long shot where they come around the corner. It's Gogol's point of view, and there she is standing there as the wax sculpture. It's a beautiful moment in the film.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Stephen and the police come to the rescue. I feel like it has a kind of disappointing conventional ending where Stephen in the climax puts his new hands to good use, you could say. And then it's just like, okay, Gogol's dead. And then Stephen and Yvonne embrace. And then just immediately the end, happily ever after. This is a thing about a lot of these old movies. It seems like they wrap up very fast. They don't have any kind of interesting coda that puts a new spin on this. Like, it's like this movie. It's like the moment the villain is defeated, the two main characters embrace and kiss, and then music swells and it's over at the end.
Well, you know, bladders were much smaller back then, and you can only make it so far through a film.
Speaking of bladders, there are some great side plots we haven't even mentioned. Actually, I don't know if they're great. There are some side plots that exist involving an alcoholic housekeeper who's always trying to get some brandy, and a fast-talking American reporter played by Ted Healy, who's the kind of guy who, you know, he sounds like a baseball announcer of the 1930s, and he's always using strange mannerisms and figures of speech. Like there's a scene where Rollo is about to be executed by guillotine, and he's there to cover it. I don't know why this American reporter is there to cover the guillotining of a criminal there in Paris, but he's explaining to the police commissioner that he's like, look, you know, you got to have gin for executions, you got to have champagne for this, and I can't reproduce it, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, but it's a kind of snappy American accent that you hear in these old films, and you end up wondering, like, did people ever actually talk like this, or is this just this sort of vaudevillian trope? Because I believe Healy was a vaudevillian comic actor. I think he had ties to the Three Stooges, even. He was part of that whole syndicate.
I think it is playing up the transatlantic accent of the time, which was, like, not an organic accent, but an accent that was sort of a product of training.
Yeah.
And so it was taking that accent and then accentuating it to unreal levels. Like it's kind of like what a lot of like pop country musicians do with their Southern accents in music today, where you're taking something that is a real accent, but just playing it up to a point that it's a parody of itself.
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of caught in a vicious circle of self-parody, and you end up with this I have to say, kind of obnoxious performance. It's just full of one-liners and zingers, and I wouldn't take it out. It's part of this film, but I feel like the modern parallel here would be an otherwise serious film, and suddenly Rob Schneider shows up and is doing some sort of goofy, lame character. Meanwhile, you have like Peter Lorre and Colin Clive, you know, doing their own crazy but ultimately seriously grounded performance.
Guess what, Mango?
What's that, Will?
So iHeart is giving us a whole minute to promote our podcast, Part-Time Genius.
I know. That's why I spent my whole week composing a haiku for the occasion. It's about my emotional journey in podcasting over the last 7 years, and it's called Earthquake House.
Mango, I'm going to cut you off right there. Why don't we just tell people about our show instead?
Yeah, that's a better idea. So every week on Part-Time Genius, we feed our curiosity by answering the world's most important questions. Things like, when did America start dialing 911? Is William Shatner's best acting work in Esperanto? Also, what happened to Esperanto?
Plus, we cover questions like, how Chinese is your Chinese food? How do dollar stores stay in business? And of course, is there an Illuminati of cheese?
There absolutely is, and we are risking our lives by talking about it. But if you love mind-blowing facts, incredible history, and really bad jokes, make your brains happy and tune in to Part-Time Genius.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Jin, and Vlastar runs the business. I understand now. He's a wise man, Marie's a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jin. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Jin, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so as we've been pointing out, this film really centers around hand transplantation. So let's talk a little bit about the science of hand transplantation and also the history of hand transplantation.
All right, well, hand transplantation is, it's interesting how this movie fits into the history of it, because hand transplantation is absolutely real now, but it was not at the time this film was made. Mm-hmm. I was looking at a paper called The History and Evolution of Hand Transplantation, published in the journal Hand Clinics in 2011 by Furuhar et al. And so one thing to note is that hand transplantation is an example of a broader class of surgeries that are now known as vascularized composite allotransplantation, or sometimes vascularized composite allograft, VCA for short. And this basically means the grafting of a whole unit organ composed of multiple kinds of tissue. So that would mean muscles, tendons, circulation, bones, nerves, skin. It's a lot of different stuff, and it all has to connect properly to be functional, which is not easy. It's sometimes described as like there's this ascending ladder of the priorities of things that you have to connect and in like what order of importance they come. And it does rely on very advanced techniques in microsurgery. Now, obviously, the surgery involved to connect a hand to an arm segment in a functional way is really complicated, but it's not just the complexity of the surgery. One of the main barriers to successful hand transplantation in history, or at least in previous decades, was the insufficient development of immunosuppression, without which the immune system will revolt and reject the new organ. The first ever hand transplant that we know of was performed by a Dr. Robert Gilbert in Ecuador in 1964, and this transplant did not really work. So the authors here explain that about 3 weeks after the initial graft, the transplanted hand had to be amputated because there was an acute immune rejection. And the authors say that, quote, this early experience, along with similar failures in animal models, led researchers to believe that skin-bearing transplants were prohibitively immunogenic. A 30-year period of stagnation followed. But then in the 1980s and 90s, new medications came online that made hand transplantation seem viable again. And they list a few examples here, including calcineurin inhibitors, cyclosporin A, tacrolimus, and MMF. And drugs like these open the doors to multiple kinds of VCA. The authors here cite a couple of the first successful hand transplants in the late 1990s, one of which actually was in France by a surgeon named Jean-Michel Dubernard and his colleagues in Lyon in 1998. So this first patient in 98 received a single hand transplant. The surgery apparently took 13 hours, and the operation was at first successful, but unfortunately the patient did not follow instructions for his immunosuppression and physical therapy, and he eventually left the care of the team in Lyon, and this had disastrous consequences, and he had to have the hand amputated in 2001. It didn't say why, but presumably this was because of immune rejection. And then the same group in France under Dubernard performed the world's first bilateral hand transplant, so both hands, in January 2000. Here the patient was a painter, 33 years old, who lost both of his hands when he was experimenting with a homemade rocket and it exploded.
Oh, wow.
Now, at the time of this review that was published in 2011, the authors believed that more than 65 hand transplants had been carried out worldwide. Most of them at this point were successful. Some had had to be amputated due to immune reactions, but most of them were successful. I haven't found a more recent estimate, but surely the number is a good bit higher than that now as therapies have continued to evolve.
You know, Dr. Cody K. Azari is a big name in hand transplantation, having served as one of the lead surgeons on six hand transplantation operations, including the first double hand transplantation and first arm transplantation performed in the United States. I got to hear him give a talk for the Moth in New York City several years ago as part of the World Science Festival. And you can listen to this at themoth.org or look it up on YouTube, I believe. But it was a really cool talk because he talks about just the intensity of the surgery. And I remember feeling I either got the impression or maybe he even used this comparison himself that, you know, got the idea that this was like scaling a mountain. You know, it was like the surgical, again, all the different types of connections that have to be made, all the concerns that have to be taken into place to pull this off. It's really impressive. And that's without even getting, again, into what comes afterward. You know, it's not a situation where you wake up Stephen Orlock and say, "Hey, you got new hands," and he's like, "Okay, I'm going to go and try and play piano." And like, no, it's there. You know, there's a drug regime that has to be followed, and physical therapy is a huge part of adapting to life post transplantation.
Yeah, and some of the sources I was looking at emphasize the importance of the psychology, like psychological screening and the psychology of how people adapt to hand transplants. I mean, for multiple reasons, but one of which is following through after the surgery is incredibly important, as was, for example, made clear by that first case where the guy was not taking his immunosuppression drugs properly. It was not following through on physical therapy, and that eventually led to the hand being rejected.
Yeah, on the psychological front, I was looking at a paper from 1999 by Martin M. Klopecki, MD, titled Transplantation in the Human Hand, Psychiatric Considerations. And the author here points out that one has to take into account the psychology of the hand, as well as the, quote, psychodynamic issues in limb loss and the psychological integration of a transplanted hand. He wrote, quote, potential candidates for hand transplantation should receive a psychiatric interview and projective testing to assess the patient's adaptability to body image, level of personality organization, and capacity for pathological regression. And one of the things that he was pointing out is that at the time, anyway, there wasn't as much of this, like, just there. You saw this with various levels of organ transplantation, mm-hmm. but there apparently wasn't as much of it in place for hand transplantation.
Yeah, and this hopefully that outlook for hand transplantation is just continuing to get better. It seems like it is, but for at least going back to say 10 or 20 years ago, I was seeing papers that were talking about the pros and cons of hand transplantation, saying, well, you could potentially get this quality of life increase, like with a transplanted hand as opposed to prosthetics, but you know, obviously there are major health consequences, like if it is rejected. So there are big risks involved as well. And it seems like over time the pros are starting to build up and the cons are decreasing. But for a while, I think there was serious debate over like whether this was a reasonable surgery to perform given all the risks and downsides.
Yeah, I mean, you can find sort of outstanding examples in either direction. So take bilateral hand transplantation, for example. You know, someone who's lost both hands and they get two hands transplanted on. For instance, some of you might remember in 2016, there was the case of American double hand transplant recipient Jeff Kepner, who made headlines saying that he wanted his own transplanted hands removed. That he had received like 10 years earlier, and it wasn't something where he was blaming the doctors. Like he's communicated that, you know, he knew it was a risk to try this out, but he, you know, wanted to give it a go. But at this point he was saying like, I just don't have functionality in these hands. Like I was better with prostheses instead. And I would prefer to go back if possible to what I had before. But then on the other hand, you have the case of an Austrian police officer named Theo Klez, who was able to return full-time work after bilateral hand transplantation. So it was very much a success story. And that story is even more dramatic because Klez was a bomb disposal expert working to defuse a bomb placed in a school by Austrian mass murderer Franz Fuchs, who killed 4 and injured 15 in 5 waves of mail bombs. I think a total of 24 mail bombs. So a rather dramatic case, but ultimately a surgical success story, I understand.
So it seems like the transplantation of hands has made great strides and I think is continuing to do so. The transplantation of heads is another theme mm-hmm. in the movie, though I don't think in the film anyone actually gets their head transplanted. It's just that Dr. Gogol comes up with this story to try to drive Colin Clive insane by saying that he is Rollo after having undergone a head transplant, which didn't actually happen. It's just Gogol in disguise.
Right. And again, it's almost feels like a tragedy that we have created such a fantastic character that is itself a fantasy within the context of the film. But I don't know. It's still perfect.
Yeah. Now, every few years, it seems like you hear news stories about a doctor or surgeon somewhere who claims that they can perform a head transplant or however you want to call it. We could talk about the terminology. It just never seems to materialize. I don't know how realistic the idea of a head transplant with modern medicine is.
Yeah, it's If we can compare hand transplantation to scaling a mountain, then then ultimately, yeah, head transplantation or whole body transplantation is the other way of referring to it. This would be the Mount Everest. Like, this would be the ultimate peak. Because
maybe more like scaling a mountain on the moon.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It would be the ultimate surgical achievement because this is something, you know, we have to face. Like, no human being has ever truly survived decapitation. I mean, certainly there are arguments and various observations about how long consciousness seems to remain in a freshly cut head, but this is only brief.
Yeah.
You're talking in terms of seconds. Right. In terms of keeping it alive in a jar or on a pan, as we see in a whole other genre of sci-fi films from the especially the 20th century, that is thus far beyond us, as certainly is the idea of taking a head and attaching a body to it so that the head can use the body. And this is where it gets kind of weird. Like, not only is this like not a surgical reality, it's still within the realm of fantasy. Like, it even further accentuates that question of what is self, what is body, you know, the idea of head and body, because it is a quite literal invocation of the whole, you know, we've talked about the mind-body connection and how it is perhaps unhealthy to think of ourselves as a brain attached to a body, a head on a body, like a rider on a horse, when instead we are this integrated system. We are essentially a centaur of mind and body. Mm-hmm. But then you have an example like this, or at least a theoretical idea like this, that you could take the head and attach it to another body, and this would be the new individual. It does raise all sorts of questions and even nightmares in the human mind.
It does remind me of the Daniel Dennett short story, Where Am I?, that we've talked about on the show before.
Yeah, I mean, it raises all sorts of questions, big questions and small questions, thoughtful questions and grotesque ones. I feel like there's at least one episode, right, where there's a head transplantation on The Simpsons. There's like a Treehouse of Horror where...
Oh, that sounds right.
Yeah, they put Homer's brain in a robot, and the robot falls onto Mr. Burns, and then Mr. Burns' head is transplanted onto Homer's body.
Why was I imagining Flanders' head on Homer's body? That doesn't sound... That's not right, is it?
Maybe they got around to that later. There are a lot of tree houses I haven't seen.
Well, yeah, with this point at The Simpsons, basically you can just like throw out random ideas, and then it turns out they already did that in an episode, and probably maybe did it more than once.
Now, in terms of surviving decapitation, there are animals that can survive longer, certainly longer than us, without a head. It's often pointed out that decapitated cockroaches die of starvation rather than just simply the loss of their head.
But there you're talking about, which one are you talking about surviving, the head or the body?
Yeah, again, it kind of messes with our conception of what an individual, even an individual cockroach is, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that whole running around like a chicken with the head cut off, which is alluding to, you know, observations that the chicken's body seems to live longer than a human body without a head. But is the body living? You know, is the head living? It gets complicated.
I could be mistaken about this because this is just off the top of my head, so to speak. But I think the reason that's observed with chickens is because the brain basically isn't fully removed. Like, you can sort of decapitate a chicken, but the brain stem is still there and functioning. It's just the upper part of the brain that's been taken away. I might be wrong about that, but that's what I recall.
Now, in animals, blood vessel reattachment has been achieved. But a full human head reattachment would require a complete reattachment of vessels, muscles, et cetera, everything that's involved in transplanting a hand, but also the spinal cord as well. And we'd need to be able to sustain the head while all of this was happening. You know, again, how do we keep a head alive after it is removed from the body? And then how would we keep it alive long enough to get it reattached? So, we're simply not there yet in terms of reattaching a head to a body. Though I love the way that it is created by Gogol in the film, you know, the idea of this brace being used to achieve a kind of like rough head transplantation. Like, he seems to have approached it with a thoughtful mind, like, oh, well, this would be a very difficult thing to pull off. The results would not be pleasant. How would I depict this to Orlok?
I think I just noticed that this entire episode, we've been saying all these names in different ways multiple times. I think I've been saying Gogol and Gogol, and I've been saying Orlak and Orlok, and I really don't know which one is right at this point. As for Orlok, isn't that the name of the vampire in Nosferatu?
Oh, yeah. Count Orlok. It is.
Max Schreck, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Let's see, is it spelled the same?
No, I don't think so. I think different it's with a spell. K, isn't it?
Yeah. And of course, I think Orlok was, they chose that name because they didn't have the rights to Dracula. So they're like, all right, come up with something else.
They should have used Alucard or Dr. Acula in the
Dr. Acula. That would have been good.
So there's another thing I wanted to talk about in this movie that I thought was interesting is that it features a couple of poems that are by two different Brownings. There are parts of the movie where Gogol quotes poetry. The first I noticed was there's a part where he's pining for Yvonne. You know, he's feeling despondent because he loves her and she's married to another. And he says, he starts reading a quote from a book. It sounded familiar to me and I looked it up. And I think the quote is from a poem by Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the English poet, Sonnets from the Portuguese Seven. It's often known by its first line, which is "The face of all the world has changed, I think." And the lines are like, "The face of all the world has changed, I think, since first I heard the footsteps of thy soul move still, oh still, beside me, as they stole betwixt me and the dreadful outer brink of obvious death, where I, who thought to sink, was caught up into love and taught the whole of life in a new rhythm." And it goes on from there, but that's the part that has what he reads. And then later in the film, I thought this was pretty interesting on the screenwriter's part. He quotes a poem when he is trying to murder Yvonne. He starts to strangle her with the braids of her own hair. And as he's leaning over Francis Drake, I think she has fainted at this point. And he quotes from the poem Porphyria's Lover by Elizabeth Barrett Browning's husband, the poet Robert Browning. And this is a line, you may have read this poem in school. It's pretty famous. In the poem, the speaker is talking about a murder he committed, having murdered his lover. And he says, "I found a thing to do, and all her hair in one long yellow string I wound, three times her little throat around, and strangled her. No pain felt she. I am quite sure she felt no pain. As a shut bud that holds a bee, I warily opened her lids again, laughed the blue eyes without a stain."
Yeah, this is a part of just that. I mean, the whole movie is wonderful, but this last stretch is just excellent. And you know, where he recites this poem while he's going to strangle her while she's unconscious, as Orlok, Stephen Orlok, and the others are trying to beat down the door.
Mm-hmm. But then I guess Gogol is undone by his own work. In addition to becoming an evil murderer, he also made the mistake of giving Stephen Orlok hands that are really good at killing from a distance.
Yeah.
Right. Orlak sort of reaches through the grate in the door and throws a knife and sticks it in Gogol's back. And then I guess somehow right after that, they get through the door anyway.
You know, it also drives home why The Hands of Orlok isn't a good title for this either, because it's basically The Hands of Rollo. That's what that's what's in the film. The Hands of Orlok are lost pretty early on.
I didn't even think
unless
about
you're
that.
Getting deep and wondering about like who owns the hands. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. In the end, also, it is mad love. It is about mad characters going mad and trying to figure out how love works.
So there is a thing I noticed about this movie as it was on Amazon Prime. Amazon declares this film to be rated PG-13. And I was like, how did Mad Love end up rated PG-13 when movie ratings had not been invented yet? Or I don't think there were any kinds of ratings. If there were, they weren't the system we have now. And certainly not the PG-13 rating, which was not invented till the 1980s. I looked it up. The first PG-13 film was Red Dawn.
They must have, my only guess here is they must have accidentally pulled the rating off of 1995's Mad Love that we mentioned earlier, unrelated film, but that was rated PG-13 in the era in which that rating actually existed.
Or it would be horrible, I think, if they are going back and applying MPAA ratings to like pre-code movies.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't even try.
Now, you might be wondering, well, where can I watch Mad Love? We already mentioned checking it out on Amazon Prime. I found that you can pretty much rent or buy digitally Mad Love anywhere that you would rent or buy a movie. Mm-hmm. You can also find it on DVD, sometimes thrown unlovingly into a multi-pack alongside far more forgotten films of the era. I watched it on a nice DVD edition that I rented from Videodrome here in Atlanta. They had a nice historical commentary track. I mean, it was clearly somebody sort of reading notes about the film, but it was quite interesting. I think this was from the Legends of Horror box set.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. As far as I know, there's not a Blu-ray of this film, at least not yet.
I didn't see one. Okay, one last question before we wrap it up. What does Stephen Orlak do the rest of his life? So maybe he just can't play piano ever again, but he's good at throwing knives. Does that become his new profession? Like, they're reunited at the end. Yvonne is saved. They embrace. Oh, we're all right now. And I guess I will enter my life in the circus as a knife thrower.
Well, you know, I so identified with Dr. Gogol that after he was dead, I was just kind of like, all right, it doesn't matter, you know, but I did think about it more after you brought it up. And yeah, I guess I imagine him taking up knife throwing, professional knife throwing, and that becomes like his new traveling act. And maybe she gets to go back into theater. And, you know, because now it's like his profession is more aligned with hers, right? Maybe they work together and they do a show together.
Okay, I see. Yeah, they do a stage show where he throws knives and she screams while the knives are thrown.
The Fabulous Orlaks, Orlaks, coming to a theater tent near you.
I love it. Okay, we wrap up here?
Yeah, let's go ahead and wrap up this edition of Weird House Cinema. Obviously, we'd love to hear from everybody out there. Did you enjoy Mad Love? Have you watched it? What do you think of it? Do you agree with us? Disagree with us? Do you have additional insights that we may have missed? Let us know. We'd also love to hear from you. Do you feel like this is a good use of our time producing episodes of Weird House Cinema?
We've heard both ways so far.
Have we? Maybe I'm blind to the criticism, but I haven't noticed anybody saying not to.
Well, I don't know. We heard from one person who said this was not for them. But
okay, well that's understandable. If the Friday night Weird Al Cinema isn't for you, just stick to the stuff to blow your mind. Our feelings will not be hurt. But let us know either way. We're excited to hear from our listeners. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Again, Tuesdays and Thursdays, you get the core episodes. And then on Fridays, we're dishing out some Weird House Cinema. If you want to find us really quickly, you can just go to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That will shoot you over to the iHeart page for our show. There's a button on there for a store. You can go there if you want to buy a t-shirt or a sticker with some sort of design or our logo on it. I will say we have a new shirt design in there by Joe Mruck, a listener of the show, who's also a self-employed illustrator. You can find out more about his work at redbuffalo.org. But he created this wonderful shirt that's a Pandora motif. Pandora opening this box of interesting, challenging, and dangerous ideas. Various show topics swirling around her. Beautiful design. You can get it on a shirt or a sticker or a poster type thing. So go check that out. You can just click on the store button and it'll take you right to it.
Maybe we'll get a Sausage Man shirt next.
We can only hope.
Something with Sausage Man and Gogol as Orlok together. I don't know.
The hands or as of Rolo Sausage together. Man.
I don't know. We'll figure it out. Okay. Anyway, huge thanks as always to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
I've been trying to write a promo for our podcast, Part-Time Genius, but even though we've done over 250 episodes, we don't really talk about murders or cults.
I mean, we did just cover the Illuminati of cheese, so I feel like that makes us pretty edgy. We also solve mysteries like how Chinese is your Chinese food and how do dollar stores make money? And then, of course, can you game a dog show?
So what you're saying is everyone should be listening.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's booted?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.